From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Another mass shooting in a divided country. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. When a self-described white supremacist gunned down nine black people in a Charleston church, official national mourning began immediately. When a young Muslim man killed four Marines and a sailor in Chattanooga, it took the president 5 days to lower the flags on government buildings. Military supporters are angry, calling it evidence of estrangement between the armed services and a society that takes them for granted. Call it terrorism or an act of war, they expect more such incidents to come. What's the likely impact on a rapidly changing South? Today's talking point, what a Texas dash cam tells us about American policing. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney back with To the Point. The FBI is conducting a massive investigation into last week's killing of four Marines and a sailor in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We'll hear what's known about the young Muslim shooter and the potential impact of the incident in southern states that are rapidly changing. Today's talking point, the young black woman found hanged last week in her Texas jail cell, was stopped for an illegal lane change and arrested for refusing to put out a cigarette. Was her real crime what's called contempt of cop? We'll review dash cam evidence with a legal expert. First, this news update. At the United Nations today, Iran was accused of flagrant human rights violations after a full year of what's called the arbitrary and unlawful detention of veteran American journalist Jason Rezaian. Bringing the charge was his employer, The Washington Post. Douglas Gell is foreign editor at the paper, and he is Jason Rezaian's editor. Douglas Gell, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Tell us first about the timing of this and then what you hope to achieve.
It's been a full year now that Jason Rezaian has been held in jail by Iran. For most of that time, there were no charges. A trial has now begun, but it's moved in slow motion. We're trying today to continue our effort to use every lever we can to put pressure on Iran to act in giving Jason the justice he deserves. He's not guilty of any crimes. He ought to be released immediately.
What do you know about his treatment since he has been in detention?
Well, the petition today lays that out in some detail. It hasn't been good. He spent months in solitary confinement, part of that time in a cell with just a mattress and no toilet. He has had limited access to visitors, very limited access to his lawyer, and his physical and psychological condition has suffered.
How do you know as much as you do?
We haven't been able to speak with Jason directly, so all of our information comes from those who've been able to visit him. His mother, Mary, has been permitted to visit him on several occasions. She saw him yesterday. His wife, Yegi, has had some occasional visits. And his lawyer has sometimes been able to see him, although, as I said, that's very limited.
He has been held longer than any other Western journalist in Iran. Is that right? And if so, what about the others? What happened to them?
In the past, journalists have been held by Iran for months at a time. In most of those cases, there's been some resolution. There's been a judicial process. There's been a sentence. There's been a pardon or a release on bail. What's been unusual and so maddening in Jason's case is that that pattern hasn't applied. He was held for months without charges. The judicial process has moved slowly. And to date, there's been no indication that they're really ready to move toward resolution of this in any way.
Is there any indication that the Iranians were hoping to use his detention in some way to gain leverage in the negotiations over their nuclear program?
You know, while we can't know what's going on in the minds of those responsible for his captivity, it's impossible to escape the conclusion now that someone believed that holding Jason would obtain some leverage for Iran. The timing of his detention, just as the talks began last summer, and the way it's proceeded throughout, particularly moving so slowly, has really made clear that someone believes it makes sense to hold Jason as a bargaining chip.
Your petition has gone to the UN Human Rights Council, specifically the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. What power does that organization have? What might they do?
It's a power of the bully pulpit in some ways. It does not have the authority to order the release of any citizen around the world. But this is a prominent group, and Iran is among the countries that have endorsed its existence, endorsed the role it plays in calling attention to human rights abuses and recommending outcomes. What we hope is that this group will grant this petition urgent action status, present it to Iran, and within a matter of weeks, reach a recommendation that we believe justified that Jason ought to be released.
You've said that he is finally undergoing a trial. What have the charges been, or what do we know about the trial itself, even though, as you indicated, it's moving very slowly?
It's operating in secret, which makes it difficult to know either the charges or the exact course of the hearings. What we do know is this. He's facing four charges, the most serious of them, an espionage charge, with a maximum sentence of perhaps 10 to 20 years. His trial began May 26th. To date, there have been only three hearings. We believe there may be a fourth hearing soon. We believe that may be the last one in this process and that it could be moving toward resolution. But exactly what's happened in the courtroom at each instance remains barred by these secrecy provisions that make it illegal for Jason's lawyer to speak publicly about it.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but have any of the previous cases been espionage cases? And if so, have reporters been sentenced to prison for that?
I'm not familiar with all the details of the original cases, but indeed, reporters have been sentenced to prison. Some have spent time in prison. Fortunately, those cases were resolved, sometimes with the intervention of senior Iranian leaders. We hope that that pattern somehow applies and that the Iranian leaders will recognize that on humanitarian grounds, on grounds of justice, Jason should be released.
Douglas Jell, foreign editor at The Washington Post, many thanks, and I think we all hope that your petition succeeds.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, another mass shooting in a divided country on To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're in Alney back with To the Point. In Chattanooga today, a Marine general and a Navy admiral remembered the four Marines and one sailor killed by a Muslim gunman last week as heroes. The FBI now has 250 agents on the scene and others running down some 400 leads around the world. The shooter is being regarded as a homegrown violent extremist who acted on his own with nobody assisting him on that day. Those are the words of the agent in charge of the FBI. Cameron McWhirter has been reporting the story for the Wall Street Journal. Cameron, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
So that was, it seems to me, the main thing that came out of the news conference today, that they don't think that there was anybody else involved.
I would urge caution in that respect. They said on that day, and, mm-hmm. and the agent, Mr. Reinhold, specified that. And I think they are definitely, you know, he said they have 700 to 1,000 agents on this case, and they're all over the globe, and they're definitely looking to see if there was any other connection.
What do we know other than the fact that his uncle in Jordan has been arrested?
In terms of his any possible ties,
yeah.
We know that we're hearing that he had there was some computer searches that he'd been making that were looking into what would be considered extremist groups. But aside from that, most of what we've been hearing is that he personally had suffered from depression and had been struggling and not being very successful in many, many areas, including employment, and was able to access high-powered weapons.
Where did he get the weapons?
We were told by a close friend that he got them from a gun equivalent of what Napster used to be, where you sort of post what you want and then people come and meet you and you purchase guns that way.
When asked about that, the FBI simply wouldn't comment on where he got the guns or how he got the guns. They just said he had three of them.
Well, they also said that we know where he got them, but they wouldn't go any farther than that.
What do you suppose that means? Are they then, is that a way of almost confirming, but not quite, that he got them online?
All we know is what we talked to close friends of his, and that is what they told us, is how he got them, and that was the way he was able to purchase these guns, which he then, they told us, kept from his family. His parents apparently were not excited that when he started purchasing guns.
He appears to have, as you indicated, done some computer searches that suggest he was interested in extremist groups. Very specifically, as I understand it, Anwar al-Awlaki and the late al-Awlaki was one of the people that he was interested in.
Correct. Yeah. But again, the FBI is not confirming that. That's what we're hearing from sources in Washington and elsewhere. But that is not the FBI is being very tight-lipped about all that. As you quoted today, the agent in charge, Mr. Reinhold, said the term he used, I think, homegrown extremist. That's as far as they're going so far publicly.
What's the impact been on that part of the country where the military has great support?
Well, here when I was in Chattanooga, it was amazing to see the every flag was at half-mast, half-staff. Flags were out all over the place. People were pouring to the site of the first shooting to leave offerings and leave letters. And billboards are going up all over the city. People are shocked by this.
Shocked. And were there also Confederate flags flying?
Yeah, so that's not, if you live in the South for any period of time, that's not unique. There are Confederate flags all over the place all the time.
What about the religious people in the South, the evangelical Christians? Do they have concern about the presence of more and more Muslims?
Well, we do have a South that is changing dramatically. We certainly have seen, I've lived down here for over 10 years, and certainly there is it's a changing South, and I think for people who've lived here long periods of time, that's somewhat disconcerting. Many people have been concerned about Muslim populations moving in here, and Muslim populations have been very anxious to make sure people don't feel uncomfortable about their presence. There have been legal battles, and there was a mosque that they tried to open in a place called Murfreesboro, Tennessee, that took years as a result of legal action, and there was vandalism at that mosque before it opened. This incident is going to set relations back considerably.
Cameron McWhorter with the Wall Street Journal. Let me introduce Daoud Abu Diab. He's president and founder of the Faith and Culture Center, an interfaith group based in Nashville. Its initiative is called Our Muslim Neighbor, and it's aimed at countering Islamophobia in America. Mr. Abu Diab, thank you very much for joining us.
It's good being with you.
How disconcerting, how uncomfortable is this for Muslims in that region?
Well, nobody wishes for any of those incidents to happen, but certainly it's every American Muslim's worst nightmare that something like this takes place. And even though a lot of those mass shootings are not carried out by Muslims, that is always a concern because of the anti-Muslim sentiment that exists, not just in Tennessee, but, the South and around the nation.
Do you think, as Cameron McWhorter just suggested, that this will make it worse?
I think no doubt that this sharpens the criticism and the sentiments towards Muslims. I think it's worth noting that I'm not sure that the South is necessarily getting worse. I think across the country, we're all more concerned with the presence of ISIS and others, other terrorist groups. But I think what is happening is maybe the concerns are getting sharpened, and people are more vocal about those, and so they are more obvious, and the Muslim community is certainly concerned about that.
Daoud Abu Diab at the Faith and Culture Center in Nashville. Cameron McWhirter, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. Is this being investigated as a terrorist act?
There's been a lot of semantical acrobatics going on about that from the officials. At one point, they called it a domestic terrorist act. At another point, they said it's being investigated as a terrorist act. At another point, they said, don't worry about those definitions, but it's kind of a terrorist act. I mean, they've been sort of dancing around that. I think the biggest question, and the one that they are pursuing very vigorously, is did anyone else help him consider this action? Did anyone else assist him in this action? And did anyone else know about it before it took place? And that is what they are very, very, very vigorously pursuing.
And as you indicated earlier, very important that the FBI agent in charge said today that there was nobody helping him on that day, being very specific to emphasize that.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Let me introduce William Salatin. He is a national correspondent at Slate. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
You have said this isn't a terrorist act. It's an act of war. What do you mean?
Well, just to comment on what we were just discussing, I think that the officials are using the term terrorism to mean that if this guy did this for some kind of Islamic reasons, at least in his own head, thinking that he was somehow retaliating for U.S. actions overseas or defending some what he believes is the interests of Muslim people, that means that his act was an act of terrorism, and that is not correct, because terrorism really should mean, it should be used in the highest sense of not just striking some people in the United States, but striking civilians. Terrorism should mean the deliberate targeting of civilians. If you didn't target civilians, if you target the military, that's not terrorism, that's an act of war.
So elaborate on what that might mean then, and if it's called that, and how does that change the way we think about it?
Well, we may be going into an era when there will be, you know, we already know that there are lone wolf strikes here. There are other attacks in the name of Islam. And I would agree with some of the previous guests that let's not confuse this with actually representing Muslim people, but people who in their own heads strike in the name of Islam. They are doing it here. And there may be more of that to come here, striking in the United States. If we Americans say every time this happens that it is an act of terrorism because they're striking us, then we are committing what everyone else in the world says we do, which is that we've just perverted the word terrorism into anybody hurting us. We have to use the word terrorism for as a way of distinguishing the worst crime. If someone is going to attack us, we have a right to fight back. But the one thing that the entire world should agree on is that you cannot deliberately target civilians. If this guy deliberately targeted the military, that's bad, but it's not nearly as bad as blowing up buses or schools.
William Salatin, national correspondent at Slate. Jeff Edwards blogs at Unprecedented Mediocrity. He is a Marine, or was a Marine, I should say, from 1997 until 2003. Served one deployment in Iraq in 2003. He is also a native of Tennessee. Jeff Edwards, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What do you say to what we just heard, that Bill Salatin says that if, in fact, the military is attacked, as was the case in this instance, it's an act of war and something that we ought to regard as that, particularly given the fact that we attack military people with drones and so on overseas?
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment. You know, given the attacker's reported internet searches, you know, given his target, it's hard, I think, for the military and the veteran community to not see this as an extension of the same war that we've been fighting for years. What was hard about it to swallow is that the Marines and sailors that were attacked were unarmed or not supposed to be armed and really just doing routine garrison jobs here in America. And I think that's the adjustment we're going to have to make, that because I agree this may very, very well not be the last attack, you know, I think we've got the military and the veteran community has to find a way to heighten our vigilance and be ready for the fight that's probably coming.
Does that mean having arms at hand?
I believe so. I believe so. You know, recruiting stations and reserve centers dot this country throughout, and towns large and small, and you know, they're designed to be open and welcoming to the community. I joined when I was 17, and I walked into the office a young 17-year-old, and you know, so they're supposed to be open there, and that would make them a potential soft target. We can't pull those recruiting centers back or pull the reserve centers back. And so, you know, the only logical course in my mind is to arm them to get ready for that day when the fight comes.
During the Clinton era, a regulation was imposed saying that people at military sites in this country ought not to be armed, because I presume there might be danger in the use of weapons. Do you think that ought to be revised?
I do. I do. It's a different world we live in now than we did in the 90s. And, you know, the threat seems to be persistent. You know, I've heard reports that they were asking recruiters not to wear their uniforms. But, you know, the fight against extremism is not going to go away anytime soon. And there's just something that doesn't sit right with the military and veteran community about asking our Marines to take off their uniforms in public, you know, here in our own country.
William Salatin at Slate. Any surprise to you that Jeff Edwards and others would say, if particularly, as you indicated, you think this is an act of war, then the military people ought to be able to fight back?
No, I absolutely agree with him. Absolutely. Because what we have to understand is happening here is that the battlefield is expanding. I mean, we have, you know, we are operating strikes in Syria, in Iraq, from Creech Air Force Base. We have drone pilots. We have, you know, we have training and recruiting facilities. That's what was attacked here. We attack training and recruiting facilities over there of the enemy. They are going to come here and they are going to try to do this. And we are insane to have these facilities unarmed. It is crazy that this guy managed to go all the way, shooting his way through this facility and then kill the guys outside the building. He went all the way through and killed people outside. He was still standing. I mean, it is insane that we do not better prepare, better arm our people. And we have this illusion that because they're stateside, they're safe. They are not.
Back to Cameron McWhirter, our first guest, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Not with us anymore. I guess we lost the connection, and I'm sorry for that. Jeff Edwards, do you want to see the United States as sort of turned into an armed camp?
No, definitely not. And I wouldn't classify arming Marine recruiters or military recruiters and reserve centers as that. You know, it's merely giving them the same opportunity to defend themselves as they would if they were at home. You know, the recruiting job is often a desk job. You know, you're there. You might be going talking to at high schools or speaking or just throughout the community. And, you know, to have them, obviously they couldn't take the weapons into the schools, but to have them to be able to sit at their desks armed, I don't think turns this into an armed camp at all.
Are there, in fact, now civilians as well as veterans of the military and others, Jeff Edwards, who are guarding this kind of facility around the country?
Yes, they are. A lot of veterans and members of the military have stepped up to step outside and provide that support. I don't know that it's, you know, the fight against ISIS and extremism, again, it's going to be a long one. And, you know, so I don't know that it's, you know, we could literally staff every reserve or recruiting center throughout America with veterans outside for that length. And so I think it's a strong show of solidarity, a strong show of support within the veteran and military community. But in the end, you know, we've got to arm those wearing the uniform to protect themselves.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation on our talking point later. What does a Texas dash cam tell us about American policing? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Talking today about the killing of four Marines and one sailor in Chattanooga, Tennessee last week by Mohammed Abdulaziz, a young Muslim man, which is, and the incident, of course, once again being investigated by an enormous staff of FBI agents, 250 to 1,000 of them, not just in Chattanooga, but around the world as well. Jeff Edwards, I want to go back to you. Again, the Marine from 1997 to 2003, blogging at unprecedented mediocrity. There was much concern about the fact that the president waited 5 days before he lowered the flags on public buildings around the country. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it was a missed opportunity to step out in front and, you know, reassure the nation, you know, mourn with the nation and pay respects early on. I'm, you know, thankful that it did happen, but I think it would have been better that day. I think in light of the attack, there was a lot of concern. There was a lot of questioning. There was a lot of frustration amongst the military and veteran community right after the attack. And, you know, I think words and symbols are powerful, and they can inspire people to purpose and action. And I think it would have been an opportunity, you know, to reassure that, you know, we're going to pay our respects, but, we're going to get back in the fight and we're going to win.
Is there a sense that particularly now that we have a professional military, fewer and fewer people are really involved in or close to people who go to war?
Yeah, there is. You know, we've been at war for 13 years now, and despite that, a remarkable low percentage of the population has actually participated. And so I think there is certainly a divide when it comes to the experiences that we've had that a lot of families can't relate to. But I do think that the burden to bridging that gap is on both sides. You know, veterans have to come back and find purpose and passion on this side of war as well. You know, as well as have an American public that is understanding to our experiences.
Let me go back to William Salatin with Slate. If, in fact, as you indicate, should be the case, the military is allowed to be armed on bases in the United States, what do you think will be the impact on surrounding communities? And will it give people who are now somewhat concerned about the who don't feel close to the military, let me put it that way, who feel somewhat divided from it, more or less reason to be friendly?
Well, I think we all have to be more concerned. I mean, let's suppose, first of all, I think we all have to start preparing for more of these attacks, that the battlefield that we used to be sort of indulged, and this kind of thing only happened overseas, and now it came home to us on September 11th. It's coming home now in these smaller attacks. This kind of thing will happen to drone pilots, for goodness sake. I mean, those guys, you know, they're operating strikes overseas, they go home to their families. There will be attacks in our communities. We don't want terrorists attacking civilians in this country. But when people attack our military, we have to stand together. We have to help them. We have to keep our eyes and ears open. You know, this is not the military's problem. This is our country's problem. And so, you know, obviously we'll find out through the investigation what we could have done. But we needed to have caught. Somebody needed to have alerted that this guy was a problem sooner. That something was happening to him. Because if we don't catch this, there will be more attacks on recruiting stations, on training facilities, and that's not the military's problem. That's our country's problem.
Who should have done the alerting? How did anybody know in advance that he was, in fact, likely to do this? As I understand it, the indication from his friends and family, up until recently at least, was that he was not in trouble.
We don't know all the details from the investigation yet. We really can't say this till it's all over. But it is extremely unusual for somebody to act in total isolation. You always find out, even in a case like Charleston, that some friend heard somebody said something, and it was, you know, dismissed as unserious or nobody thought anything of it. It's only in retrospect. But we all have to be eyes and ears.
Let me go back to Daoud Abu-Diab with the Faith and Culture Center in Nashville. What's your take on what we're hearing about the responsibility of people to be alert and turn people in, and particularly given the location of new battlefields here in this country?
Yeah, I think we have, as Americans, all to be very vigilant all the time, and I think the Muslim community is very well aware of that. I would have to say that I don't think we have been able to identify, you know, a mass shooter at a movie theater or at a school. And certainly we are not, as individuals, Muslims in the community, we don't have the resources to really identify somebody who is a threat unless there are certain statements or activities that take place. And what I've heard so far is that there hasn't been really leads to make any of the Muslims in that community identify this specific guy as a threat. I think what happens is often when things of this nature take place, they are interpreted in some existing narrative. And it is important not to do that and wait for the facts. This individual, I agree, may have not decided to do this overnight, but it's not a single factor that led this individual to decide to be a criminal and carry out this kind of activity. But at the same time, it is not that he was acting so obviously or preparing for this over time. And so far, we don't know if there were anybody aiding him. So it is not as easy as it sounds, just like a mother couldn't tell that her son was going to be a mass shooter of a movie theater.
Nobody anticipated that the shooter at the Charleston church would do what he did either. Bill Salatin, are you asking too much to say that people need to be alert and try to study other people and turn them in when that seems to be when there seem to be a threat?
No, I guess the way I would put it is I'm not saying that this is easy in any case. First of all, I'm not calling for a surveillance state in which everybody turns everybody in. I mean, the truth is that in lots of Muslim communities, lots of mosques around this country, there is already sort of an informal process of if somebody, you know, if somebody really sounds like they're a problem, a word is passed and somebody is talked to about it. So that is a kind of internal policing that goes on anyway. But what I'm really describing is an imperative. It is that if you can have a lone wolf, if you can have a strike in this country triggered by social media, triggered by just being on one end of a smartphone and having some ISIS recruiter on the other end, who knows what, you know, what any given case involves, then in that situation, the strike is already coming from someone who's inside this country. So what you're trying to keep an eye out for is not infiltration, it's radicalization. So I guess what I'm suggesting is that we need to change our usual mindset from watching out for the enemy coming in to watching for someone being turned into an enemy, especially someone who's troubled with mental health issues.
Mr. Abu Diab, it's my understanding that you had a firebombing at your institution, did you not? Are you concerned about that kind of attack being repeated?
Yes. In 2008, my Islamic center that I founded was firebombed by three people of the Christian Identity Movement. And, you know, since then, there's been a few other incidents targeted at the Muslim community and Islamic centers. And just as you referred to earlier, there are armed civilians in Murfreesboro protecting a recruitment center carrying machine guns. That's very intimidating, and that's very challenging to the law that is above all of us. And I can't imagine if a group of Muslims showed up with machine guns and decided to challenge the establishment and take the law in their own hands. It's not acceptable for one group, and it's not acceptable for another group. I don't think that it is fair to necessarily say Muslims are a threat, and so I'm not sure that those individuals have the training needed. This is a facility that has other shopping and commercial property. So it is dangerous. I have friends who are very concerned about such displays, and particularly when there's no information that has come out to suggest that there is a large network or anything of that nature.
Let me go back to Jeff Edwards, our Marine, former Marine, who blogs at Unprecedented Mediocrity. What about Islamophobia in Tennessee? That's where you are a native. How widespread is it? How much of a concern is it?
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it that way. Certainly you have people who are given to, extreme views on that. But I think for most people in Tennessee and probably most in the country, everybody's just really trying to wrestle with, different sets of truths that they've come to know. I don't believe that every Muslim, wants to kill me. And I even harken back to that my time in Iraq when I was part of a country, part of a force invading that country, not everybody over there wanted to kill me. So, I mean, that's the truth that I know, and it's the truth that I understand. And I think different people's life experiences would lead them to have more or less empathy along those lines. But at the same time, the threat of radical Islam is real. And so as people are wanting to believe the best, and they do believe the best, and they want to get along, these stories keep popping up. And I think the mainstream of the public is just trying to wrestle with these truths. And I think the more that we have open conversation and dialogue about it, the better off we would be. To his point about, weapons outside of recruiting and reserve centers, I mean, that's my understanding that, wherever people are guarding it, they're following the laws of their state. If their state allows open carry, they're open carry. If it's concealed carry, they're concealed carry. So, I would support everybody following the law along those lines as well.
Okay. Mr. Abu Diab, what's the theory in the Muslim community, to your knowledge, as to why Mr. Abulaziz, the shooter in this case, did what he did?
I think the majority would focus on the fact that he had a troubled past and that he's dealing with depression and drugs and things of that nature. There's certainly nothing within Islamic teachings that promotes violence of this kind. It is unless it's self-protection, and in this case and in other cases, it has not been. I think most of us are safe. I would say, though, that it is not appropriate to say that there is not a threat from Islamic terrorism or terrorism that is committed by individuals who happen to be Muslim. At the same time, it's inappropriate to say at a time when there has been more violent acts against Muslims than by Muslims against non-Muslims in the United States, that the threat from Muslims is more noticeable, is more present. It is more noticeable simply because of the narrative that exists. When a Christian commits an act, like in Charleston or a mass shooting, it is never attributed to the teachings within Christianity. We accept that this individual may be misguided. And I think the same should be afforded to Muslims. It is very important that the Muslims be continue to be a part of the solution. And I agree that being vigilant and reporting is very important. There's been several plots that have been thwarted because of Muslim reporting. So it's very important to have a conversation that is to the point, if I may say that, rather than be misguided by a lot of the emotional interpretations and agendas, particularly Islamophobic agendas, and specifically in Tennessee.
Jeff Edwards, your take on that?
He's right. I do think that the Muslim community, certainly has to be and is, part of the solution. I think that we certainly need to have to the point conversations about this, and even the conversation we're having here today for the listeners. I think that it's an important dialogue to happen because again, I really just feel like people are trying to wrestle with different truths. For better or worse, my experience, my viewpoint going forward will always be marked by my experience in Iraq. That's a very vivid experience. Everybody brings their own unique history, to the conversation. So I think the more we talk about it, the more, you know, certainly everybody seeks to have empathy for one another as they're wrestling with the truth that they've come to know, you know, to be vigilant and to, you know, encourage the conversation is probably the best way forward.
All right. That's all the time we have. Jeff Edwards, again, blogging at Unprecedented Mediocrity, a Marine, 1997 to 2003, served in Iraq, a native of Tennessee. Thanks so much for joining us, Daoud Abu Diab, president and founder of the Faith and Culture Center in Nashville, our initiative called Our Muslim Neighbor, aimed at countering Islamophobia in America. Thank you very much for being on our program. William Salatin, a national correspondent at Slate, thank you very much for being with us. And our earlier guest, Cameron McWhirter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal based in Atlanta. Great to have you all. Thank you so much. The coroner in Waller County, Texas, called it a jailhouse suicide, but authorities are investigating it as a case of murder. What does dash cam evidence reveal about why a young black woman was originally arrested? Back in a moment with today's To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. Since Sandra Bland was found hanged in her jail cell last week, her family says the verdict of suicide is unfathomable. They have demanded to know how a routine traffic stop led to her arrest in the first place. Yesterday, Texas officials released video recorded from the officer's dash cam.
You mind putting out your cigarette, please? Don't mind.
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
Gloria Brown Marshall is professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. She is author of Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to the Present. Thank you so much for joining our program.
Thank you.
We will hear more of that dash cam as we go forward. Does that conversation, the first part of which we just heard, sound familiar to you?
It sounds familiar because this has been playing, of course, across the country. As we watch this video and are shocked and appalled by the behavior of a law enforcement agent.
Well, I didn't mean to sound familiar because you've been watching it, and as so many people have over the last couple of days, but rather, is this a common way for police officers to address people when they stop them for, in this case, moving from one lane to another?
Well, I don't think so, but I think it depends on who the driver is. I don't think he would have addressed a middle-aged, upper-class white male in that manner, but I think he felt in the power dynamic between a police officer and a young African-American woman that he could speak to her in that manner.
So you think, then, that this is a case of making a difference because of race?
Race and gender made a difference. How this young woman speak to him in a position of authority in that manner, or not follow his... So longer he then decided to use his power and authority, and we see how that's going.
Let's hear a little bit more of that conversation between the police officer and the late Sandra Bland.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said,
for your failure?
Get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order.
Door. You
I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car.
Get out of the car. Right.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a
over there.
Gloria Brown Marshall, back to you. What about the behavior of Sandra Bland? Was she, do you think, egging the officer on?
No, I don't think she was egging the officer on. Police officers have to be able to interact with all different types of people. And I'm sure he has or should have, in his job as a police officer, encountered someone much more belligerent than was Sandra Bland. The other concern I have is the fact that I wonder how he interacts with other people when he stops them. It would be interesting to look at the other interactions he's had on the dash cam to see if he approached all of the drivers that for something as minor, not on her signal to change lanes.
Let me introduce Jamila Lemieux, a senior editor at Ebony magazine. Thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested in your take on what we are hearing, what we have been seeing, those of us who have looked at the dash cam video, and I think that's a lot of our listeners, no doubt. What do you see when you look at that?
When I look at that video, I see an officer that approached a woman with needless aggression, needless anger, who was abusive, who was unkind, who was disrespectful, and who seems to be in violation of her legal rights and her rights to simply be treated with dignity, even if she was accused of violating the law in some sort of way.
He mocked
her, he laughed at her, and I believe that ultimately this encounter in some way, shape, form, or fashion is responsible for her death.
Do you think that he would have behaved that way if she had not been a black woman?
No, I have no. I honestly, there are cops that are rude and dismissive to citizens of all creeds and colors. But what history has taught me is I have no reason to expect that a white woman would have been treated that way.
Gloria Brown Marshall, back to you. You're a lawyer. The case is being investigated as if it were a murder, even though the coroner found that suicide was the cause of her death. What's the significance of that?
Well, we have to consider the fact that someone looking at this from the outside sees a vibrant young person, just received a job, happy with life, now face down on the ground, violently dragged into a jail cell. We don't know what happened in that jail cell, but we have to say that if the evidence of what we saw in broad daylight on a public street gives us any foundation for the behavior of law enforcement, it must have been very debilitating at the least whatever she encountered in that jail cell, in a cell that was probably one that we could not see from the viewpoint of the camera, and it might have been chosen for that very reason.
So there's no video inside the cell, and there won't be. Do you know anything about the investigation of what happened in the jail while she was incarcerated there, particularly on the day that she was found?
All we know is that they checked on her. They claim a reasonable number of times. And then the last time they checked on her in the morning, they found her standing with the plastic bag wrapped around her neck as a noose, and that they have no idea. They did not see any change in her behavior to give them any indication that she should be on suicide watch. So it's all very strange, especially for someone who had not indicated in that time frame leading up to it that she felt depressed or to the point of suicide. We all go through changes in life. But what we also need to take into account, if we could, is to look at this night in isolation. We keep looking at these cases that, especially the events that have taken place, racial events, last 165 days, must realize that we can see this in isolation. There is something going on, a pattern of practice of abuse rights of black people.
Okay. Jamila Lemieux, back to you, senior editor at Ebony. All of the cases, or most of the cases that we have heard about, recently, and there certainly have been a lot of them, Michael Brown and Eric Garner and others, have been involving young black men. Have women been left out of the conversation, and is it important that they be brought back in?
It's absolutely important that we bring women back into the conversation, and there's been a really, I think, critical, dedicated effort to do so, particularly on social media and through the efforts of activists. If you search the hashtag Say Her Name on Twitter, you'll come up with the names of many women like Sandra Bland who were either killed by cops or who died in police custody under mysterious circumstances. So we can't act as if this is a problem that's exclusive to black boys and men. It's a black problem.
It's interesting that the officer asked Bland at one point, how long have you been in Texas? She, of course, was from Illinois. I presume she had Illinois license plates. What's the significance of that question, do you think, given what we know about the South?
Well, it definitely felt like a loaded question. You know, what are you doing here? What are you doing down south? How well do you know this area? You know, it's as if he was speaking. Of course, I can't pretend to know his frame of mind, but you got the implication that he was speaking in code, you know, telling her, little girl, this isn't your place. You don't belong here, because it doesn't seem that you know the lay of the land, because she approached him like someone, or rather when he approached her, she spoke like a woman who had agency, who felt confident that she hadn't done anything wrong and that she should be treated with respect. And that, you know, in certain parts of the South and the North, there's an unwritten rule that African Americans don't have a right to express themselves in that way.
We often hear that the sons of black parents at some point in life have a conversation about how you need to deal with the police and how careful you need to be. Is this a conversation that families also have with their daughters?
Yes, as a mother of a daughter, it's a conversation that I certainly plan to have with her when she's of age. And as a child of a retired law enforcement officer, it was a conversation that I had many times that was had with my older sisters. And, you know, it was made quite clear to us. You know, we didn't talk so much about how the police interacted with just young Black men, but how they interacted with Black people, and that I was susceptible to that at any time. Being in the presence of a young male may have made those interactions more loaded or, you know, perhaps more difficult, but it was made very clear to us that we had to be respectful almost to a fault when dealing with law enforcement, and that even behaving in that way could not protect us from the possibility of police aggression or police violence.
Sandra Bland obviously was aggressive back at the police officer. What do you think?
I don't know that aggressive back.
Maybe aggressive is the wrong term, but she resisted his authority. Let's put it that way. Is that always a mistake, or is that something that just happens? Was she perfectly within her rights to say what she said?
We are perfectly in the right to say what we want to say to police officers. You know, there's no law that says you have to be kind to a cop. You have to submit to arrest when someone's attempting to put you under arrest. You have to follow laws. So being, you know, using a curse word at a police officer or telling them that you know, take issue with the way they're speaking to you is not being aggressive. It's being assertive. And in many cases, it's because people are aware of their rights and that they're being violated. Unfortunately, many of us have learned that when dealing with police officers, you could say that it's best not to do that, but I think it's important to say that even if you follow the law and do everything that you're supposed to do, there's no guarantee that you're going to be treated with respect and dignity by a police officer.
Jamila Lemieux at Ebony, I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's all the time we have. Gloria Brown Marshall, thank you both. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.